Thank you, and welcome everybody. My name is Kurt Opsahl. I'm the Deputy Executive Director and General Counsel at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and I'll be moderating this panel on IoT cybersecurity and federal legislation about it. And so first, let me have our panelists introduce themselves.
You want to start at the end?
So all right, Xavier, why don't you start off?
All right, sure. Hi, my name is Xavier Ash. I'm a hacker. I've been doing hacking since the late 80s, worked in information security since the early 90s. Currently am running a security engineering group for a bank that happens to be a couple doors down. So I'm here to bring the kind of the security side of it from a point of view.
Hey everyone, my name is Erica Portnoy. I'm a staff technologist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I am one of the principal engineers on CertBot, which is EFF's Let's Encrypt client, helping people to get free certificates for their websites. I also do a bunch of work on crypto policy. I have a background in cryptography and security engineering.
Hi, my name is Nathan White. I've had an interesting career that doesn't fit neatly into a box. I used to work for Congress for a lot of years on technology issues. Then I was a political operative for a little while, helping campaigns around the country win. Most recently, I worked with Access Now as a human rights activist, and I currently work for a company I'm a little afraid to mention after the last panel, but we were recently fined $5 billion by the FTC. My title is Privacy Policy Manager for ARVR, where I work on advanced research and emerging tech for that company.
All right, super. We're here today to talk about IoT. IoT, of course, meaning Internet of Things. Internet of Things security has been, well, somewhat challenging over the years as people have been adding the Internet to many different things, sometimes to provide cool new features, sometimes because they feel like they have to put the Internet on everything because Internet. There have been also a number of challenges that come with that. So one common thing is people will have hard-coded default passwords and credentials, which make it so it's fairly easy for anyone to come along and hack at it, and they're hard to change. Another issue has come is when these devices are distributed, placed in people's homes, they're operating. Maybe they were secure the day they came out, but then a vulnerability is found, and there has been no easy upgrade path. In some cases, to upgrade it, you'd have to sort of deinstall it and connect it to something else. Or in other cases, it's simply there is no update path. The only way of updating it is removing it and throwing it in the fire and then buying a new one. And this is something that, you know, people will not frequently do. Congress, in its wisdom, has said they want to try and do something about it. This is a frequent thing of Congress. When they see a problem, they want to do something. What that something is probably not as important as having done something. And in this case, we're looking at two of the bills. One of them is the Smart IoT Act. And I'll go through that one relatively quickly because it isn't seeming to be moving very much, and even if it did, it's not that big of a deal because it directs the Department of Commerce to conduct a study on the state of the internet-connected device industry, which, you know, go for it. that seems like a perfectly good thing for the Department of Commerce to do, we could benefit by having a little bit more information about it. That bill passed the House in 2018, the way Congress works is every 2 years it is a new congressional session. So when you have elections and new people come in, this is the next session. So any bill that didn't become law disappears. It has to be reintroduced if it is going to be considered by the next session. And so even though it passed the House, and seem to have potential legs to move forward in December 2018, it didn't. And so here we are in 2019, and it would have to sort of start over again. And the second one is the IoT Cybersecurity Improvement Act of 2019, and this one is moving along a little bit more strongly. So I'll give a brief overview of that. So the basic gist of it is to use the federal government's procurement power to improve practices. So the federal government buys a lot of things. Some of them have Internet of Things on those things. And if they have requirements we will not purchase anything that doesn't meet these various standards, that provides an incentive for industry to rise to the challenge. Going over one of the things that it does, requiring NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, to issue recommendations addressing secure development, identity management, patching, and configuration management for IoT devices. NIST is part of the Department of Commerce and generally has some relatively smart thinkers about this sort of things. And one of the challenges has been that there hasn't been readily available standards that people can look for to do security by design. And then it directs the Office of Management and Budget to issue guidelines consistent with these NIST standards. And then requires these guidelines be used by government agencies for internet-connected devices purchased by the government have to comply with this.
Kurt, is there going to be a test on this at the
end? Yes, there will be a test. Yes, we've just introduced it testing this year. The bill also directs NIST to work with cybersecurity researchers and internet experts to publish guidance on coordinated vulnerability disclosure. As we're taking a moment on, one of the things that also has been challenging for a long time in the security world is how to handle vulnerability disclosures, where a security researcher might find that your internet-connected toaster can be remotely put on fire, and there's no path easily for the security researcher to coordinate a vulnerability disclosure, first to tell the toaster manufacturer, get it fixed, put out a patch, talk about the underlying flaw to advance the knowledge of security. It's good to have a path on this. And one of the things that is a little bit new and different for IoT is that technology companies are sort of stepping back. Mainline technology companies, big websites like Google or Facebook, Intel, chip makers, Cisco, router makers, they have paths for security researchers to disclose vulnerabilities. Sometimes they will have an incentive program like a bug bounty to encourage that. They have sort of worked it out. So if you want to disclose a vulnerability to them, where to report it. They have some instructions on how to import it, what kind of information is useful, and it's relatively, for many of the companies, relatively smooth process for getting things fixed. But for a lot of the IoT companies, they are not used to that world. They were making toasters and doorbells and home thermostats, and for those who weren't used to it, and then they get somebody reporting. First of all, they don't always have a path, so it's someone coming in through customer service, and so getting that escalated to somebody in security is often hard, and sometimes they react badly to this because they're seeing it not as a relatively routine happens. You have to constantly be improving the security of your products, but more of a, oh my God, someone is going to be writing about how our toasters are insecure, and this will be a PR nightmare. We have to stop this and get to a more adversarial relationship with the researcher. So trying to improve those paths would be definitely a useful thing. And turning back to the bill, the final thing is it requires contractors and vendors providing the devices to adopt these coordinated vulnerability disclosure policies so that when a vulnerability is reported, it will go through a good path. So there's a lot of good things here, though there are some details about how the bill is structured. that could be troublesome. One of them, which was introduced in markup, for those who are not familiar with the legislative process, is when a bill goes to a committee, and then they go through a process called marking it up, which is basically introducing amendments, making changes, and so on. And in the markup of this bill, they expanded upon a concept that had been in there previously about a waiver, that in some circumstances you can waive having to comply with these shiny new guidelines that NIST is going to put together. And at least in the most recent form of it, that waiver pretty much would allow a department to opt out of this bill. And that kind of, you know, potentially makes it pointless. This is a bit of a challenge. I think some of the issues was like, well, we really need this thing, and they're not ready to meet the standard yet. And I can see where, you know, people are coming from when they want to procure something and it's not available, meeting all of the standards. But then again, we also have come, I think, as a relatively widespread opinion in the security industry that meeting good security standards is extremely important, and so that's the whole point of the bill. So that's an overview of the bill. But now I think I'll turn over to our panelists to talk a little bit more about this. Should we start with, I guess, one of the threshold questions? What? Tell me more about the problem we're trying to solve.
I guess I can start with as commonly using these things to get what I need done. So I guess there's several problems with IoT devices, and a lot, you know, it really kind of jumps into both consumer space and obviously business and government, since a lot of these pretty much every HVAC system, communication, like putting the projectors and stuff at businesses, they're all over the place. They're all very, very well connected. Anybody, all devices now like to have some type of connectivity, and so you really have two kind of I think threat areas here is your external attacker, right? So there's been at least one historical, very large botnet called Mirai botnet, and what it did is it specifically attacked, specific types of IoTs that had a vulnerability in it, and it became, created a huge botnet that then went and attacked other websites. So literally, yes, your toaster could have been, attacking other companies. This is, continues to be a threat. There hasn't been a big coordinated botnet like this, but we still continue to see device takeover. So they're basically that where the devices itself get taken over by a bad third party. I think another threat is the company itself and what it's collecting, right? So how many of these devices have microphones? And what are they doing with those microphones, the video cameras, the data that's collected, and then the companies that put these out? A lot of these companies don't survive very long, get bought out by other companies, and so your data gets moved along. So I think there's two big areas is external hackers that want to use your device for nefarious reasons, and then the people that we bought it from, making sure that they don't misuse the technology in that way.
Thank you. I spend my day working on certificates, so obviously I'm going to come at this from the certificates perspective, but one of the big problems I see with IoT devices is certificates. But it's actually more indicative of a larger problem, because one of the fundamental ways of building devices is completely different when you're a connected device versus when you're not connected device. When you manufacture an unconnected device, you send it out into the world and it can be used forever, no problem. But when you're an IoT device, they're unfortunately keeping to that same model instead of doing the model of software engineering and security, which is you're always going to be having to update this. The ecosystem is always changing. You need to be getting the latest updates. One of the ways that this has played out in the past couple of years in terms of certificates is in point of sale devices. So this is the cash register when you go to check out at Target or something like that. In the old model of things, when you ship a device with everything it will need forever, you ship it with a certificate baked right into it. But that certificate, let me define certificate. So when you want to have an encrypted connection with another device, what you're going to be doing is you're going to be signing with your own private key to their public key, et cetera, et cetera. You're doing a lot of signing going on, and you want to prove that you are the device that you say you are, and the way you do this is providing something called a certificate, which is essentially someone else that you trust said, hey, we do think that this particular device belongs to this particular key. Great. Anyway, you're going to need this thing called a certificate. They update over time. These are the key points here. So the point of sale devices shipped with these certificates, and they shipped with the state of the art at the time. SHA-1. Okay, so I hear a bunch of laughs because SHA-1 is what we can kindly call deprecated these days, which I'm using to mean completely broken. The encryption done with these devices, with these certificates, it's not as if you might as well have not done the encryption at all, but it's like just one step above that, right? But unfortunately, there was no update mechanism for these devices. There's no way of getting a new certificate. There's no way of changing it. So for years, when TLS 1.3, which is the latest version of the TLS standard, which is how you do encryption over connections, came out, there was this huge argument, and it got pushed back for years because all the makers of these devices, which had shipped these SHA-1 certificates, said, we can't do this. If you do this and you say these old broken certificates are actually old and broken, everything that we do will break. And the people writing the spec were like, yes, that's exactly the point. That's why we want to be doing this. So anyway, there was this big arming back and forth, and eventually, like, there were certain exceptions carved out, but for the most part, like, at the end of the day, people needed to update their certificates, and the extensions were so that they could figure out how to get these certificates onto the devices. But if you're not building that in at the start, it's much harder to do it in the first place, and that's a problem with many of the old manufacturing processes that lead to a one-time situation in the devices.
Man, I love Dragon Con. This is so awesome. I spend most of my time between DC and San Francisco, and the idea that 80 people would come together on a Friday morning to talk about Smart IoT Act, like, and you paid to be here. This is just the coolest community there is. I'll be, I guess, controversial on this panel and say I'm actually really excited about the Smart IoT Act. Commerce should go research this because IoT is a really complicated problem, in part because most people mean something different when they say IoT. When we talk about problems with IoT, everybody sees a different problem. A lot of security researchers look at them and say, these are unsecure. Somebody's going to hack a toaster and start a fire. Government looks at IoT and they say, oh, botnets. Botnets are bad, and they're using all these things. Then just public interest advocates say, well, these things need to be updated. We're building all this technology and putting it out in long our farms. We need to be able to do stuff with that. We need to be able to update it. We need to be able to get useful information. We need to be able to recycle it. We need to be able to address the whole life issue of it. Then there's also the policy side of things. If these things collect massive amounts of data on various things, and those things are going to be shared with other systems. Bruce Schneier, a couple weeks ago, security researcher, a lot of people know, he's a good guy, was at Dragon or DEF CON, and he was saying the next generation of computer technologies are not being built for you. They are being built for computers to talk to each other about you. We have a lot of different systems that collect information and exist in those silos. When those devices can start sharing information to other silos, a lot of the problems that we're dealing with now become exponentially more difficult. So with IoT, we're trying to solve the problems that we got here, the problems that we have today with all this information. And my particular interest at this panel today is where the future is about to be going. Where a lot of people in Silicon Valley are predicting a next platform shift. We went from desktop computers to mobile computers in your pocket to the next platform shift is expected to be wearable devices that you keep on your face all day long and are interesting in lots of different ways, including they can communicate directly to other people. So right now your phone connects to a server and goes out to the internet. You can turn on Bluetooth and sharing so you can communicate directly with one-on-one. But imagine the new platform shift where all of our computers are talking to each other behind the scenes, saying where the maps are, where the crowds are, things like Waze. We're just at the very cusp of that, and IoT is not really thinking about that yet. And if we don't figure it out, if Congress doesn't start paying attention, if advocates don't tell their members of Congress to pay attention, we're going to get to a really, really scary place where there really isn't a lot of regulation or control over this, and we're going to figure it out as we go. We've seen the last few years, figuring it out as we go with the internet is a little bit problematic. It's also going to be a little bit more challenging when we're not talking about, oh, well, we wasted a lot of money, we put a bunch of sensors in the field, and now they're broken. This is going to be, these are devices about you sharing information about you that might have your biometric information, your location data, your history, where you've been, lots of things about you. And when they fail and go wrong, you will be the one who might actually have the harms. Rather than the government losing money, you might lose some of your privacy, or you might lose some of your data, or you might just not be happy with the experience. But we really need to start figuring this out, and government needs to take it seriously. So if the way to do that is Congress says, commerce, go study this and come back and tell us what you think, on behalf of the company I work for, I don't have a position on the bill, but that seems like a really good idea. We should learn about this.
All right. Well, I mean, I think that brings an interesting sort of question, which is, what should be done about it? So, one is sort of this free market approach, and then the Cybersecurity Act is an attempt to put a thumb on the scale of the free market approach by providing an incentive for companies to do this. Now, there's more pure free market approach where you think that security is a value, and so companies should provide this because it is valuable. This seems to have not always worked out, and maybe this is just a matter of getting more people concerned about the importance of security, getting places like Consumer Reports to which they're starting to do add security as a part of their rating of consumer items. Or maybe raising attention to the issue through the commerce studying it. Though, I mean, a concern I would have with the SMART Act is if that's what Congress did, that they might say, and now we've done something, and it won't necessarily address the problem. On the other hand, government regulations also have a set of problems that they are often mired in a particular security time period. And so you might have like a government regulation. You sort of imagine if they had come out with this a number of years ago, they must say, it would say, you must use SHA-1, because at the time that they wrote the regulation, that was the standard by which you must use. And, it's hard to future-proof them. So I guess, what is the better approach? Should we have government regulating what is allowed, doing it by putting this incentive out there as proposed in the cybersecurity bill, study the issue more? What's the best approach?
I think that if those of you who don't work in tech, NIST is a government agency, like I said, works in the area of commerce, but puts out a whole lot of very good recommendations and guidelines that federal agencies have to abide by, that are often then picked up by the commercial and private industry too. Set as a standard, and even if it doesn't end up being required that all IoT devices must have a NIST qualification, that at least sets some bar in allowing that. The other thing that I'd like about the smart IoT or the IoT bill that's proposing using NIST is that at least leaves those technical guidelines to the people who actually know them. I much would rather listen to have NIST write a guideline for us to follow, because I believe there's much easier way of getting an input and having that be technically astute, and they update theirs over time in a way that is expected, as you wouldn't have if this was codified. So I think they take a pretty good approach in allowing NIST to set those standards. But I do hope that they look at things like requiring something like a certificate, but also saying that you must have a way, like we said, to update things that must be updatable, must and have these more like you've got to do this like you're writing software, not like you're making toasters. I worked with a company that based out of Sweden. They have a series of coffee makers, and one of the things that they said that allowed them to really get the funding to get the right type of teams in place, to actually do software, iteratively and release and update and things like that. They were just going to outsource it and buy it from this one company. This consultant will write a code, we'll put it on the coffee maker, we're done. As they said, we're going to make this a a way to know how our customers are using our coffee makers. When did they use it? What buttons do they push? What type of coffee are they making? This can be fed back, and now it's business intelligence, and now has value to the rest of the company. And so that company was then be able to say, all right, now we can get the money to provide full stack and full lifecycle management. A lot of these other IoT companies, they don't take it that way, and so hopefully there's going to be some incentives to allow for that.
You know, it's interesting that you mention NIST. I have a lot of thoughts about standards bodies. So I'm a big NIST fan over here. Last fall, in fact, I went to their conference on threshold encryption because they're considering putting together a new standard for something about threshold encryption, and a lot of the discussion was about what exactly do we need here. And the thing that I took away from that discussion from the people at NIST who put together these standards in the first place and many of the experts that they'd brought in on the subject matter to have that discussion is that the place of a standard is for talking about primitives. So you want a standard for your hashing algorithm, you want a standard for your encryption algorithm, you want your AES to be standardized, you want your SHA-256 to be standardized. But what you don't necessarily want is your best practices and system-wide recommendations to be standardized, because then you're in danger of getting into something like FIPS, which if anyone works in any sort of system that has to deal with those, I see some nods in the room.
What's FIPS?
Yeah, so FIPS is the Federal Information Processing Standard, and it is the requirement for if you are doing governmenty things and you have a governmenty machine, you got to follow some requirements, which is a great idea in practice. It says really useful things like, oh, you shouldn't use MD5. MD5 is a really old deprecated hash standard. Unfortunately, in practice, these overly stringent guidelines turn into things like, oh, well, now you can't have Git on your machine. You can't have a version control software because Git uses MD5 under the hood. And even though it's using it in actually a perfectly safe way, this overly broad standard is just completely saying that you can't use that in the first place. So what this is all to say is it goes back to that idea of you want more flexible requirements for your system design. And so I think that there is definitely a place for NIST, for standards to talk about many of the primitives, but I feel like one of the big problems in IoT isn't that there aren't standardized primitives out there, it's that they're not taking into account the best practices. And I think there's a real danger of being overly specific about the more system-wide best practices, and we can't completely just rely on a standards body for those sort of things. And you definitely need some manner of external pressure beyond just a standard.
So I think the question is, what can we do? Yeah. And the first thing that we need to do right now is pull out our DragonCon apps and rate this panel. I'm getting some trash talk from the previous panel. They're saying they had more fun than us. But seriously, if you could actually do that, that does help a lot. It helps the organizations that we work for be able to send us back. It also sends the signal that these topics are important and you're willing to hear it and willing to sit through these wonky conversations. We're probably going to move to questions fairly soon and want to get into what you're interested in. There's also the feedback in the app. You can tell us what you're interested in and we can focus more on that.
All right. Well, that's what a great idea. You should totally do that. I don't know. We're about halfway through it. I think that might be a good time to start talking to people about their questions. And we have the throwable microphone. So just
short throws.
Short throws, not big throws. So, have some questions.
So you guys have mentioned that the next platform and wearables and that interconnectivity and the data farming from that. My question is, what is being done to keep it, that much collection of data can be good for humanity, but like we've seen in the past, it can be weaponized. Do we really want like a consumer branch to kind of regulate that, to study that? Like, what are we looking into as an industry to how to prevent that data to be weaponized against consumers?
I think I'm probably a good candidate to answer that question. So I recently started working at Facebook about 6 months ago. Previously, I spent 4 or 5 years at AccessNow, which is an international human rights organization, working on tech policy issues from a human rights perspective and the user's perspective. The reason why I went over to Facebook is because entirely I'm working on this issue. My job is privacy policy for augmented reality and virtual reality, emerging tech and advanced research. My goal with this job right now, one of the reasons I convinced them to let me come to this conference, was to spark these conversations. That a lot of people look at VR, especially because we've had it since we've been talking about it since the 90s in Lawnmower Man, and it's always been like coming. Part of my job now is to try to get people to realize this stuff is coming a lot faster than the world thinks. We're talking about regulation for problems that are addressing now, whether it's on privacy or IoT or cybersecurity. The world's about to change pretty quickly and pretty dramatically. And if we collectively as a society don't raise our voices, have opinions, work with groups like EFF and Access Now, work with members of Congress to be talking about this, it's literally going to be a mostly white men in Silicon Valley who are making decisions about this. My job is to try to not let that happen and to try to bring people into this conversation. But like the one takeaway is I'm up here like raising the alarm, red lights. This stuff is coming faster and you need to be asking those questions a lot of different places. Answering that question, what we're actually doing and what we're thinking about it is really, really complicated. And I would love to talk more about that. We should have way more panels on that next year.
All right, more questions.
Yes, hi. I have a question related more to the vulnerability management reporting. What is the U.S. CERT doing to make it easier for smaller companies and companies who are not used to having to report vulnerabilities to them to get the certificate you're required to have in order to be able to report to them?
That is a very good question. And I've worked with people who have successfully reported things through CERT, but I have not heard from them any problems getting a certificate to do so. So I actually don't know the answer to that.
I think in general you're talking about CVE is trying to get that reserved CVE number. And once you once you've identified and confirmed with the vendor or confirmed that you have that vulnerability, you know, you can get one reserved even though you might not publish it for disclosure reasons.
Let me rephrase how I phrased that question because I don't think I was clear. I work in a federal environment. I am the owner of a federal environment for the federal government for a SaaS service. My SOC team, which is required by my company, which is a large software company, to be the team that we report to that then reports to the U.S. CERT around our environment, had difficulty with the U.S. CERT being issued a PKI certificate that allows them to actually communicate to the U.S. CERT software to report the vulnerability initially, which we're required to do in this environment within an hour of detection. We're a large company. We have the resources, the manpower, and the money to do so. What are they doing to make it easier for these IoT companies that don't have the experience, that don't have a team dedicated to it, and don't have the money and resources if they're a small startup?
All right. Well, that sounds like an excellent idea for them to do. This is not part of the bills as drafted, except for maybe it could come out of the NIST standards, because one of the things it says is they have to develop a manner in which things can be reported. And I guess I'll pull up the language for a second, because it is a little bit, it's brief.
I was saying that there might be, the California Privacy Act is probably going to drive more than this particular IoT Act and the ability to report privacy issues. But there's definitely a challenge. It's not currently addressed.
So just so you know where the act stands in it is that NIST, in consultation with cybersecurity researchers and private sector experts, public guidance on policies and procedures for reporting, coordinating, publishing, receiving information about security vulnerabilities for the covered devices, the IoT devices the bill covers, and the resolution of that. So within that process, I guess that makes it NIST's problem to figure out a method of doing that. And oftentimes when NIST goes through that, it's actually required that they consult with cybersecurity experts in industry. So hopefully during that consultation process, that issue could be raised. And I mean, in order to successfully achieve the objective here, it would have to allow for low resource companies to be able to do that. So that if this passes, probably the method of getting that forward would be providing comments to NIST.
Hi. As a consumer, looking at IoT and the vast ecosystems that all seem to be competing with each other, you were saying a second ago about we're looking at kind of forward at the technology being different and it advancing. Are we looking at kind of narrowing things down, or are we all still looking at all these competing ecosystems and I'm going to sink $500 into something that's like Betamax, right? Is that going to change anytime soon?
Could you restate that? Because I have two different answers and I'm not sure which question I heard.
Yes.
Are you worried about consumer technology that technology, because there's so many different things out there that technology is evolving. For example, Kickstarter I'm backing just ended this morning for a glasses called Norm. These are sunglasses, look exactly like sunglasses that have a forward-looking camera for capture, display. I don't really know what they're going to do. I'm also getting shipped another pair of glasses called Form Focals by a company called North, which don't have the camera forward. Instead, they have a camera toward your eye so they can display information directly into your retina. These are early form factors for the new platform shift that people are going to think. I have no idea if either of these are going to be any good. I'm getting them because, you know, I work in the space and they're kind of neat and I want to see where the technology's at. But from my perspective, I'm probably going to buy some $500 devices that are going to be like Betamax. We don't really know where the technology's going, and all these companies in Silicon Valley that are putting tons and tons of money in this, they're all pursuing different paths and kind of looking at the same direction. So from a consumer point of view, yeah, there's going to be a lot of things that just don't work out and don't make sense. From the government side of things, that's exactly what they were talking about a couple minutes ago on why we can't really specifically say, do X. Because do X might be completely just worthless a year from now. It's more about how do we get these companies to incentivize, think about X. You generally make toasters. You've been making toasters for 20 years. You make good business making toasters. Hey, it's really neat. We can put the internet in toasters. Let's do that. If you're going to do that, that comes with a whole bunch of responsibilities to update it, secure it, make sure that people can't hack into it, make sure that if it emails you that it's using proper up-to-date certificates and using the latest things. If the government mandates, if you build toasters and you want to put the internet on it, you must do X, Y, and Z, we're just wasting each other's time. Like, that's just a recipe for disaster. So it really does get complicated. We don't want the government to mandate that you do certain things, and that's why these kind of bills are designed to, well, let's study it. Let's use the government's buying power to incentivize, to say, all right, well, we are the government. We spend billions of dollars buying things like toasters. If you want to make money selling toasters, here are the requirements. You have to document that you thought about these things, that you have a plan in place for how you will update it when we require you to update it.
I also just wanted to, riff off one thing is on sort of like the $500 devices, because that one of the things for privacy and security is that in some cases, if you pay a lot, you can get better privacy and security. And I think a prime example of that is comparing the Apple iPhone. Apple puts a tremendous amount of energy into security and in having privacy practices with a phone versus a Android phone that you might be able to get for $30. Super cheap, very easy, works as a phone, but oftentimes doesn't have an upgrade path. Eventually, or at least, you know, sometimes they will, you know, basically orphan it, say we were no longer providing security updates, and yet these phones are still out there. So there are, you know, literally millions and millions of people who have phones that are completely insecure, but they're continuing to buy them because a $30 phone is what fits into their price range. And I certainly would not like to have a future in which there is like a vast difference in how much privacy and security you have depending on whether you can spend $700 on a new iPhone or you just need to get the cheapest thing available to get what you need done. And perhaps having standards like system-wide will be helpful for that, where if it becomes an industry standard, it may be a little easier for the smaller, you know, the cheaper end of things to comply or may be forced to comply. That we also have to consider, what if this means that some devices are previously in reach and now out of reach? And that's an important policy issue to make sure that happens in this, is that we don't take useful devices out of the hands of people because of the costs.
So we talked about IoT, but what about
security gateways, or the routers into our homes that are kind of like the gatekeepers into everything. And I know the stuff that we buy from Best Buy is not always the best. I personally rolled my own router because I know I'm much more secure. But people don't think about rolling their own. It's too, the barrier of entry is too high. Are we looking at that in some of these builds as well?
Well, that's actually been one of the larger concerns about these bills is the definition of IoTs. The original bill had some conflicting information. They've refined some of that. And then in some cases, like either the House or the Senate bill version right now, just basically says the NIST is going to tell you what an IoT is. So then it kind of just, you know, kicks the can in that way. Like I said, makes it a little bit more flexible because the definition of what we say this year is a little bit different. But yeah, there's and so that's actually something we need to keep an eye on when this goes through legislation is, you know, what's the scope of this and making sure that things like that do apply.
So I want to push back on something, or I'm going to be an avatar and I'm going to defend an institution that I don't work for. Congress is really hard to do anything, especially on tech. That if you think about it, if you're a member of Congress, even if you really care about this issues, even if you see that as a problem, there's not a lot of incentive to a member of Congress to introduce a bill that would do that. You'd have to, one, figure out how to do it, how to define it, how to navigate between companies and interests to get to the exact right thing, to get the outcome that you want. And then you're a member of Congress, so your job is to make your constituents happy and get reelected. All of that work doesn't really help you get reelected or help you with your constituents. So it's a really, really difficult thing to do without any reward. So there aren't that many members of Congress that prioritize it. Instead, you could prioritize things like Medicare for All, which people understand. Healthcare is directly involved in a lot of people's lives, and it's politically salient. You get on the news, you get people talking about it, and people know your positions, and you feel like your constituents are fighting for you. So one of these bills we were talking before the panel, I was trying to figure out what the updates were, because the last time I had looked at it was 4 years ago when they were working on this, and there were a few different sections in it. And this is a bill that's now been reintroduced and going. And it's because, for one, Senator Warner has a staff member named Rafi Martin who really cares about this issue and has been pushing it and convincing his boss, who's good on this issue, that it's worth his time and it's worth paying his legislative staff to work on this. But he doesn't really get any cheers for it. He doesn't really get across. That's why one of the things that they do is, we need to study this. We need to give somebody a responsibility to do it that is outside of Congress. If we say, Commerce, you must do this. NIST, you must come up with this. They have professional staff who get paid 8 hours a day or whatever to figure that out. So in some ways, we need to figure out ways to either incentivize Congress to take this seriously, and that's by people like us in this room who understand why it's so important, telling them it's important to us, or figuring out ways for Congress to direct other people to solve some of these problems, whether it's NIST or whether it's third-party conferences, whether it's security researchers, but people who are invested in this to actually figure it out.
All right. Oh, lots of hands. All right.
Hey, so we've been talking a lot about consumer tech, and I think probably because we're all consumers, and the people in this room tend to have more of a cyber look at things. I'm wondering what in this bill, or if not in this bill, what the panel thinks we can do to start to engage some of the folks, like I'm in the physical security industry, smart buildings, smart HVAC, smart cameras, smart access control. It's all networked and ridiculously poorly secured. How do we move industry, if we can't move Congress, how do we move big industry to care about this? Because it's one thing for my toaster to get hacked. It's another thing for my access control system to get hacked.
Yeah, no, this is a very very important point. I mean, that industry has been often unwilling to invest in good security, and then when we were having a crossover between physical and network security, which is, say, if you hack the network security, get onto the system, you might be able to open the door that otherwise would have been locked, that this can be an issue. One incentive that industry has is that if it goes wrong, then that's a problem. If someone breaks into their building, if someone gets into their stuff, that this is a problem. And it's just to continue with the conflating. A lot of these things, which are things like HVACs or access control points, are connected to the rest of the system. And when I've known some people who, you know, work in the penetration testing industry, and often that's a path in, that it is one of these sort of smaller devices that is insecure that gets them onto the network, and then they escalate and eventually own the whole network. But this is a tough thing, because the incentive is, if something goes wrong, you're going to have to pay some money and have a big problem if it goes wrong. But until something gets wrong, it's nothing but a cost to increase security. And people are often not good judges of what the likelihood of things. Again, an optimistic approach, it won't happen to me, or, you know, we're having trouble meeting our quarterly numbers, so one thing to cut back on is this basically insurance against something bad happening, and see if we can ride this out for another quarter and show some nice numbers to Wall Street. And so that is a tough thing. And what the bill is trying to do to address this is by putting incentives for people selling things to the government to improve, that they will also apply those same techniques and technologies to their consumer and, you know, business to business offerings.
Just to take a quick opportunity to maybe do a slight dig at the employer of someone at this table. You know, you could think of it as a cost center, you could think of it as important in protecting people, but you could also think of it as consumer trust, right? And I think that's the thing that's the first thing that goes. When a big breach happens, when there's a big privacy leak, the first thing to go is the buyer's trust. And so it's something that, until it happens, it's hard to convince people to do it. But once that incident happens, after that, it's hard to recover from the trust that the consumers, the users, whoever is buying this system has lost in the company. And that's a lot easier to keep than it is to rebuild.
It's one thing to say that, but I mean, do you still go to Target? I mean, do you have a Home Depot? TJ Maxx? I mean, these are all companies that had extremely poor security. And from a financial standpoint, you know, they really have not been punished. With every, you hear a breach today, there's another one got breached. It's not a big news anymore, you know. And so one of the things that us as Americans get, you know, we're inundated, you know, and we give away our privacy so much, we have not made this a priority, and we have not, like, we might feel and think about that trust and whatnot, but we're not shopping with our feet. We're not saying, all right, you know, this company, you know, breached my trust. Now I'm going to shop at another place. So until we decide that trust is important enough to spend a little bit more money on, you know, going down the street or going someplace that they don't want to normally do business, we got to get out of our comfort zone and say, hey, this is important to me. Privacy is important to me, and I'm going to show it with my spending habits. So.
Yeah, questions mainly for Nathan. So, you know, it seemed like as technology gets more complicated, our elected officials get further behind on their technology, I guess, education. There was a guy that said that the internet's a series of tubes, it has poker chips sticking it up, right? So at the federal level, is there a type of program for education that teaches them some basics, like maybe the CIA triad, or do they just hand that off to a subcommittee or some kind of, like,
That's a fantastic question. It's actually how I started my career. I was working for Congress, and I was just sort of blown away by the fact that no one really understood what they were talking about. But things have actually gotten better in the last 10 years. Believe it or not, it used to be a joke line that a member of Congress would get up and say, I don't understand the internet, ha ha ha, send in the nerds. Now nobody makes that joke anymore, because it's sort of like, yeah, you don't need to understand all the details, but this is pretty important. It's not a joke anymore. People's lives are actually impacted by this stuff. So there is a trend toward members of Congress getting better at this stuff. Lots of them understand that they don't really know it, but it's important for somebody to know it, and they're taking it more seriously. There are a few awesome programs trying to get even better. One is called Tech Congress, which is a program to put technologists in members of Congress's office to help them actually do the work and give them ideas for what can happen. One of the best things that happened for cybersecurity in the last couple of years is ACLU's technologist, Chris Segoyan, went to go work for Senator
Wyden.
Wyden. he's doing awesome stuff because he understands the technology, and he's now got the position of authority where he can write to, hey, Department of Defense, I noticed you weren't using HTTPS. What's up with that? And Department of Defense are like, Senator's asking why we're having insecure websites. Let's fix that. So they actually do things on it. There used to be a committee that existed that was a neutral, nonpartisan committee, not like the committees that we have now where it's Republicans and Democrats, but an advisory committee that's job was to advise members of Congress about technology issues. The revolution, I think it's called the Republican Revolution in 1994, when Republicans swept into Congress, there was a contract with America, and one of the things was, we're going to get government out of your life, and we're going to make government smaller, and we're going to get rid of unnecessary bureaucracy, and they canceled that department. Somebody's going to help me remember. Office of Technology Assessment. There is a growing movement that desperately needs to come back. That is a bipartisan movement from pretty much every technology policy person I know in D.C. supports that. And it's one of those things that Congress could do because they don't really need to do anything except throw money at it. That's one thing they're good at. They don't have to understand it. They don't have to solve the problems. They say, exist, give us nonpartisan advice. Right now, that's a little bit difficult to accomplish, I think, in this current Congress. Everything's a little difficult to accomplish this current Congress, especially when you start talking about technology and there's ideas about partisanship that exist in those technologies and those platforms. But that is one thing I fully support. Anybody who wants Congress to get better, support the Office of Technology Assessment. We should come up with a better name for it.
And I wanted to just add one other technique that we use. So at Electronic Frontier Foundation, we try to educate Congress, so we've done things like bring in some experts, have a panel, and then Congress people send their staffers to go to that and learn also. We made a very, I think, good panel on how encryption works and trying to get into, you know, our policy issue was we don't want them to mandate backdoors and reduce the security of encrypted communications. But to move that forward, you have a lot of education to do so people understand what encryption is and why it's a challenge to simultaneously have security and have plain text access, which they have some people saying, oh, that'll be fine. So we provide that. It's also something that commercial lobbyists do, providing education. So you might imagine sometimes these things are not neutral education, but it is a process where staffers can learn things. And usually each a representative these days will have at least a staffer who kind of looks at cybersecurity and these kinds of issues, some more educated than others.
Can we get the question up here? He's had his hand up for a while but been too modest. I don't know if you can see it. Wait, there's a box now.
Get the box.
Thank you. This question kind of goes back a few minutes. But my thought was, if you have people like targets and loose handling our data loosely, wouldn't a really large lawsuit that hit them in their pocketbook be kind of solve the problem? You know, there's a reason I don't speed and I don't park illegally. I don't like the financial hit.
So I have a response to that, but first, everybody in the room, I'm taking off my corporate hat. I'm not speaking for a company. I'm speaking for myself, only for myself. Really large lawsuits can do a lot, but think about what's going on right now with the opiate epidemic across the country. Massive, massive problems, and states have been gathering together, they're following the tobacco lawsuits, and they're suing them. And right now, a judge is considering whether or not a $10 billion fine for Purdue Pharma is enough to spread around the country. And what they're actually thinking about doing is turning Purdue Pharma over into be a publicly owned company that will continue to run, and the profits will then go to fund this. The judge is looking about whether or not this is a good idea, whether that will be a good outcome. The fine is literally so big, it might shut down this company. And the people who are on the other side of it are saying it's a drop in the bucket. It's you spread $10 billion around every community in America that's been affected by the opioid epidemic, and it really doesn't do that much. So, yes, on the one hand, yes, pursue all methods to do it. Lawsuits matter. Lawsuits do get attention. Fines do matter. Fines do get attention. But that can't be the solution, the holy grail that we're looking for, because the problems that society faced can't always be solved with money. A lot of times the most important resource we have is our attention.
So I might just add a little piece to that. One is that...
Oh,
And there was recently a company that got a $5 billion fine, and their stock price went up that day, which meant the market thought that the fine would actually be higher and that this was fine. So, very, very large numbers. Yes, absolutely, on security things that you say, I would rather put money into security than pay, billions of dollars. But it still hasn't trickled through all over the place. Capital One, they just had a breach because they didn't secure their Amazon Web Services buckets. And they had a huge stock hit when that became news, and they're obviously going to have a bunch of class action lawsuits.
Speaking of lawsuits, I have a theory for something that's going to happen in the future. I've been in a bunch of different data breaches, from OPM to Target, and as a consumer, and a lot of times these companies, the government will do this too. They're going to give you credit monitoring for a year or 2 years. I have credit monitoring from like four different places, from like five different breaches, and I don't even remember which one is which or where they came from. If something ever happened that there was financial harm, those insurance companies are going to sue each other to figure out who has to pay for it. But I'm kind of waiting. Eventually, this problem is going to get so bad that giant corporations are going to have to litigate against each other to figure out who pays for all these damages. And that is an outcome I'm kind of looking forward to.
All right. We have just a few minutes left, so let's try and get a couple more questions in. Keep them short, please.
Hi. So I noticed that a lot of IoT devices aren't so much in the consumer space, but also things like energy and transportation. And I wondered if focusing more on like the national security aspect of it would get Congress to be more proactive on it rather than just consumer side.
Wasn't that one of the things on the waiver?
Yeah,
it was. So this new waiver thing that they added to one of the versions says, here's reasons for having a waiver where you don't have to apply this, and national security is one of those. So.
That's hilarious.
So which so is like the opposite approach, right?
Exactly.
Which is that, like, if it's important for national security, then screw these standards, as opposed to
supporting national security. Hold on. So back to my point that this is hard for members of Congress. Let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Say you're a member of Congress. You've been working on this bill for 3 or 4 years. You really believe in the agenda, and somebody from some three-letter agency comes and says, this bill will hurt national security. What are you going to do? You're going to say, well, I'm going to give up because, I can't argue? Or are you going to go up against one of these three-letter agencies and say, well, you need to be public, you need to figure it out, we need to do this, which is an entirely different battle that a lot of the people on this stage have been fighting for the same amount of time, but is another different battle? Or do you say, if you are one of these three-letter agencies, you can have a waiver. You can go to NIST and you can say, for those very rare cases, we're just not going to apply this to you, but the benefits outweigh that for trying to do this for the consumer. We can still use the big government purse strings to do it. So, yeah, the waiver section, sure, I get why it's easy to laugh at, but I can also see the other side of the argument on it, that would you throw away a bill because it wasn't perfect, or would you say, this gets us part way down the line, it gets us somewhere, and then we should just keep doing better?
All right, I think this will be the last question.
So my question is whether in any of these legislation or regulatory options, there is any option for opting out. So I bought a car a couple of years. I literally cannot turn off the monitoring that is in my car without disabling whole computer systems that make my car work. And I also bought a water heater a couple of years ago, and increasingly there's two companies that make all the water heaters, and they're putting IoT connectivity in all the water heaters. I'm like, I don't want that. So are there options for being able to opt out of these built into any of these guidelines?
Not in this bill, but it does raise an issue that has come up a couple of days. There's the set of legislations or legislative proposals under the right to repair, which is sort of embedded in this notion that if you have a device and you purchase something, then you have a right to make changes to it. It's coming mostly from situations in which you buy something like a tractor, and then it's broken, and because it's a complex system with all these computery things in it, they make it so it's hard for you to make any changes to it, and you have to go to the manufacturer to get it repaired. But in that same concept is the notion that if you buy something, it is yours, and you can make it so it working for you and not working for somebody else. And that is a much broader and very important concept, that whenever you have something, right now, you own it, you can set it on fire and toss it in the ocean, you can do whatever you want with it. And instead, we have things which are, if they're yours, but they have aspects of it which are not really yours. You can't control them, and they may be working against you. And I would definitely like to see a future in which any device that you have is either working in your interests, or you have the ability to stop it from not working in your interests.
The area to pay attention to on this one is agriculture, by the way. For a lot of big farmers don't even own their tractors anymore. They license the right to operate their tractors. It's a little scary when you think about our food supply. It's literally salting the earth type stuff.
All right, and then we're going to come to the end of our time here. So please do rate this panel so that DragonCon knows how great it was. And thank you all for coming. We'll see you around.